You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson on today's show.
The Senate report that was released yesterday highlights that there was not good guidance, that there was not good leadership, and that there was not proper oversight of a lot of these programs.
The White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest there. After the CIA's interrogation techniques are blown open, my studio guests Ivor Gaber and Jim Hoare will tell us what they think might happen next. Plus, we go through the rest of today's headlines, including how a series of leaked documents could damage the EU president, and can the world's defence departments keep ahead of their game. Also ahead, we check in with our woman in Vancouver for the latest news where she is, and we speak to the author Tom Cheshire. He's written a book about life in the Maldives outside the honeymoon resorts. And then, with a mouthful of sugar plums, we perfect our pas de deux as we review the new dance performances here in London with the Financial Times' Louise Levine. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Before that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
Israel says it's investigating the death of a Palestinian government minister who collapsed soon after a violent confrontation with Israeli troops in the West Bank. Saeed Abu In died in an ambulance on the way to hospital. News footage shows him scuffling with troops and border police. At one point, a soldier is seen with his hands around the minister's throat. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has called his death a barbaric act. Palestinian official Hanna Nashrari.
I have a sense of outrage. Ziyad was guilty of nothing more than planting olive trees where Israel would uproot trees, was guilty of nothing more than ensuring that we remain on the land where Israel was trying to expel people, that we save the land where Israel was attempting to steal the land.
A report in Brazil has highlighted torture, executions and forced disappearances under military rule in the country. The Truth Commission says the human rights abuses were official policy under Brazil's military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985. The report was handed to the president, Dilma Rousseff, who herself was arrested and tortured by the military regime. It's identified almost 400 people said to be responsible for human rights abuses and says those who are still alive should be brought to trial. The UN's human rights chief has said no one involved in the CIA's brutal treatment of terror suspects will be let off the hook. Said Radal al-Hussein says American officials who authorized harsh interrogation, seen by some as torture, could face prosecution under the Convention Against Torture. After the publication of a damning US Senate report, a former Polish president has admitted for the first time that he allowed the CIA to set up a secret interrogation center in his country. But Alexander Kwasniewski says he had no knowledge that detainees were being mistreated. Robert Freer is from Amnesty International.
This will renew scrutiny on other countries as well as, of course, on the US. And there will be, you know, litigation. You know, for example, just earlier this year, the European Court of Human Rights ruled on the complicity of Poland in the program. And I think we will be seeing more of that kind of thing.
The head of the Nobel Committee has described this year's Peace Prize recipients as champions of peace. The Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai shares the award with the veteran Indian campaigner for children's rights, Kailash Satyarthi. At 17, Malala is the youngest ever recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. The head of the committee, Torbjørn Jagland, praised both of them.
The role of campaigning and struggling people, people who have created the global conscience of which we can all be bearers, the call for freedom and justice. And the most important thing is to set children and young people free.
The Frenchman released by al-Qaeda militants in Mali was reportedly freed as part of a prisoner swap. Serge Lazarevich was the last French hostage held by Islamists. It's now reported at least two militants, including his alleged abductor, were freed from a jail in Mali in return for his release. France has repeatedly denied paying ransoms for hostages. Russia's currency, the ruble, has fallen to new lows against the euro and the dollar. It dropped further after the central bank in Moscow refused to intervene in international currency markets. Since the summer, when sanctions were imposed on Russia over the crisis in Ukraine, the value of the ruble has fallen by 40%. Currency analyst Denis de Jong fears the situation could get worse.
We do hear some rumors in the market that there might be some currency restrictions coming out of Russia. And I think if we look at the bond spreads between Russian bonds being traded in Russia and with that of Russia, you can see that the risk premium with bonds traded inside of Russia is quite significant already. So I do believe that we will see further pressure on the ruble today.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York,
to Tokyo,
to Buenos Aires,
to Zurich,
to Hong Kong,
to Toronto,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Time here in London is 18:06. In New York, it's 13:06. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio is the academic and historian Jim Hoare, former British diplomat based in Seoul, Beijing, and Pyongyang, among other destinations of which I'm sure, and Ivor Gaber, professor of journalism at the University of Sussex. Welcome to the studio, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hope you're both
Thank
comfortable
you.
And raring to go. Let us begin with the CIA. It is 24 hours now since the CIA's interrogation techniques post 9/11 were blown wide open to the world. The Senate report detailed torture, humiliation and brutal interrogation. The CIA has responded by saying that their behaviour helped to save lives. But the report counters this, saying there's no evidence any plots were ever thwarted. Now the debate begins over who, if anyone, should be brought to account. Jim, I'll begin with you. This report has been widely acknowledged as exposing practices which many said needed to be exposed and were ripe to be exposed. No one was that surprised.
I think that's probably right. It's, not, alas, not just confined to the Americans. You will probably be aware that there's been a story this week about the British in Kenya again and the suppression of the Mau Mau, in which there certainly seems to have been torture used. I think it's going to be very hard now to justify the Western dialogue on human rights issues, to condemn other countries for human rights violations, as the United States and Britain and other countries do, in quite the same way that they've done up till now, because this exposes that we are, in fact, in many ways, just as bad as anybody else.
Ivor, would you agree that what has been exposed as being conducted by the CIA pretty much undermines any moral or legal standing that America may well have when pursuing other nations in their record of human rights, such as China, for example?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? This story has been running very big in China, and they've been using it to say, look, you know, we're a bit fed up with America and other countries blaming our human rights records. I don't think there's an exact equivalence, but I think it's pretty shocking. I think you're right that it's going to put America for the within the next few months in a very difficult position. And if there are revelations about British involvement, as there certainly will be, there's a court case currently against Jack Straw, who went relating to his time as Foreign Secretary, which might well bring out some very messy details about British involvement. Having said that, and this doesn't undermine it, but I do think in the international community, in international organisations like the UN, we in the West still have an obligation to state and restate the importance of human rights and freedom of expression. And even if we don't do it perfectly, and we certainly don't do it perfectly, it is still an important moral issue that we should take a stand on.
So this now turns, would you say, Jim, to the international body, such as the UN. We'll talk about the ICC in a minute, which is examining what it can do next. But the UN's human rights chief, as we heard in the news, has said no one involved in what happened will be let off the hook. I mean, how on earth do they pursue them?
Well, the other complication in all this is that in both our case and in the United States case, of course, there's a new government, and the new governments in both cases have said we are not doing this and we've stopped anything like this, so that they're distancing themselves from the past. And it is then very difficult to to follow up on these things. Or at least we say it's very difficult, but we're not above pursuing other people in other countries over crimes that often went back a long, long way. I mean, the classic one, of course, is the Germans and the Jews, but there are other cases as well.
And also failed ones, for example, the United Kingdom tried to bring action against General Pinochet, but for some silly legal reason, it didn't quite happen. But in terms of the way that the America itself can examine what it can do, and Jim has just mentioned, Ivor, the fact that everyone is going to politically distance themselves from what has happened. But surely there is a need for justice to be seen to be done within America.
Well, except, yes, there ought to be, but this issue has become highly politicised. As we know, this report was only written by Democrat members of the Congressional Committee. The Republicans refused to associate themselves. The reason it's now published is the Democrat leader of the House, Dianne Feinstein, feared, probably rightly, that once the Republican majority takes over in the new year, it won't ever be published. This issue is highly politicised. I suspect, and here I don't know, but I suspect that if a Democrat is returned to the White House in 2016, this issue will be resurrected and legal action might well be taken. But at the moment, with a Republican majority in the House and the Senate, nothing's going to happen. And if there's a Republican in the White House in 2016, this issue will be buried.
To what degree, Jim, do you think that other countries now are going to be starting to sit a little bit uneasily? I mean, we've heard from the former Polish president, Aleksander Kwasniewski, who's admitted that he allowed the CIA to set up a secret interrogation centre in his country. The ICC has also said that individuals, members of the CIA, who may well have committed these acts of torture in countries who have signed up to the ICC may find themselves subject to prosecution.
I think in many countries now there's going to be a lot of very worried people. I saw one report from the United States today about the former US ambassador to the United States, Christopher Hill, who got lots of plaudits for his handling of the North Korean nuclear issue. But it was Christopher Hill who persuaded the Poles that they should engage in taking American prisoners. And that all over the place there will be. Now, that said, there's a number of countries who were involved who probably are not over concerned about the whole issue. I mean, I don't want to name them because I can't remember them all. But there's Afghanistan and there's other countries that really aren't going to pursue this sort of issue very much. And pursuing it from outside the country, I think it's not going to be terribly easy.
Why do you not think they'll pursue the likes of Afghanistan wouldn't pursue it? Surely it is arguably on the world stage. It is in their interest to, yeah, okay, there are the obvious economic and military support that the United States bring, but to what degree would somewhere like Afghanistan actually benefit internationally from saying, no, we will pursue these individuals?
I think many countries think this is how you behave. This is how you handle prisoners and you know, for a long time, we would not sign up to a series of international agreements because of what we were doing in Northern Ireland.
And it's worth adding that the Americans are not signatures to the International Criminal Court. And even if names were named, they wouldn't be taken to the International Criminal Court because, ironically, the Democrat president of the United States would protect them because he has no legal mandate to send American citizens to the ICC.
It was Bush, indeed, who actually removed their attachment to the ICC, wasn't it? 14 minutes past the hour. Let us continue now with the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, who's come under pressure after leaked documents show more and more multinationals may well have been involved in a complex tax avoidance scheme in Luxembourg. The country's former prime minister is facing questions about just how much he knew about a scandal which is now engulfing the likes of Disney, the Skype internet phone section of Microsoft and Koch Industries, among other big names. Ivor, is it any great surprise that Luxembourg is considered to be a tax haven?
No, it's not a great surprise. I suppose it is in the context that the former long-serving Prime Minister of Luxembourg is now the top bod in the EU, and it does cast a bit of a pall over the EU, particularly because tax avoidance at a time of austerity and the time of the Eurozone crisis is seen to be morally indefensible. And things are beginning to move on that front here in the UK. We've got the so-called Google tax coming in. And I think it actually is and might well be a long-running problem for Mr. Juncker. Whether multinationals will find ways around any EU legislation, any British legislation, well, if you have high-paid accountancy firms who are both working for the Treasury, the British Treasury, and working for these multinationals, they probably will find a way around. But is it a surprise? Alas, no.
What do you think, Jim? You chuckled when I suggested that Luxembourg is quite good at tax.
To be honest, it's capitalism, isn't it? This is how business behaves. I was at a lecture on Monday night about perceptions of Japanese businessmen in the 19th century, and they were all crooks, and they didn't stick to contracts, and they evaded their obligations. And discussing it afterwards with a number of people, including some businessmen, they didn't seem to be terribly surprised. And that I'm not surprised. This is frankly how they behave. They're there to maximise their profits, not to follow ethical standards. They follow the legal. They'll keep within the legal terms. But this is clearly legal, but ethical, no.
I wouldn't wish to race to their defence, and I'm not racing their defence, but I like the elegance of their defence, saying this is nothing to do with making profits. This is to do with our moral obligation to get the best possible return for our shareholders, those ordinary men and women in the street whose insurance policies, whose pensions are dependent upon us doing this. So we're actually being terribly moral. But that's not my view.
We're praising their fiduciary duty, aren't we? Now, but given that context, obviously we have a climate which you have just described, which is perhaps not the most savoury in terms of morals and ethics, but is quite good in terms of profit. But at the heart, we have the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, who now finds himself in the biggest chair in the EU Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. To what degree do you think that he not necessarily knew about what was going on, but perhaps chose not to look?
I think the idea that the Prime Minister of Luxembourg did not know the tax regime that operated in his country, he may not have gone into detail, but he knew the broad principles.
Emma, I think he's almost confessed it, because he said, we are competing with other countries to try and get inward investment. We have very favourable tax arrangements. I think it's indisputable. I'm not sure he's ever denied that he knew. But what he would say is, these were the rules, we followed the rules.
He's wriggled a little bit. In an article that I read earlier, he just said that he was not the architect of the Luxembourg model because this model doesn't exist. He's almost suggesting that everyone's got it wrong.
Well, I think you're being very generous. I think other quotes, I think, clearly he knew, but he said he did nothing wrong. As Mr. Schmidt of Google said, as everybody says, we stuck to the law. Well, sometimes the law is wrong.
We now have a situation, though, where we have a man at the EU Commission who has come from a country that is widely accepted as being incredibly clever when it comes to accountancy. To what degree does Juncker now become poacher turned gamekeeper?
I would imagine he's going to find it very difficult to play that role, although he will presumably have to do so. But I think you're right. We come back to the basic thing. These things that were designed to attract businesses to Luxembourg, other countries do the same sort of thing, and they're designed so that these companies pay, once they're in those countries, they pay very, very little, and they certainly don't pay in the third countries where they're making their profits. To me, the whole system is rotten and wrong, but you know, one man isn't going to change that overnight.
Would you agree?
I do, and I'm feeling slightly uncomfortable sitting here in London because we in the UK are probably responsible for more tax havens around the world than any other country, and we've done very little about it.
But we have a situation now whereby okay, I'm going to be massively hopeful here. You may laugh at me. If you have someone like Jean-Claude Juncker at the top of the EU Commission, his competition department is investigating Luxembourg on its tax rulings and avoidance strategies. He knows the system. He also knows the EU inside out. He's operated on the inside for, 2.5 decades? Could we one day find ourselves embracing a new, more transparent tax system as a result of what might have happened in Luxembourg?
We can all hope. I think the EU and transparency don't necessarily go together. Nor do transparency in Luxembourg go together. I think if what you say was to come about, it won't come about under Mr. Juncker's watch.
And, Christmas is coming and dreams will be fulfilled, so maybe you're right.
There speaks the journalistic equivalent of Father Christmas. Thank you very much indeed for that, Jim. Right, let us conclude this section with a trip to Hong Kong. The final demonstrators in the financial district have been told to leave ahead of the area being cleared. After 74 days, the protests may well be finishing, but those who've been campaigning for a more transparent political system say they'll carry on. But how? Jim, I remember at the beginning of this whole episode in Hong Kong's history, one commentator saying the mainland will just let it fizzle out by itself because nothing will come to nothing like this. Would you agree that this is the ending that everybody expected?
Sounds like me, actually. I don't know whether it was, but I think one of the problems for the demonstrators was that it was very much a young person's protest. It didn't attract much beyond the student and other young people's attention, involvement. And so, in a sense, they were always isolated from the main group of people in Hong Kong who, frankly, see making money and conducting business as the main purpose in life. And that goes right from the top of the political groups right down to the man selling flowers on the corner of the street.
But at the start, it was very much not about student protests. It was a popular protest, and families and Hong Kong workers, the groups that you spoke about, were all engaged in it.
But they quickly dropped away, and that's the problem. It never really got the sort of momentum that happened in Seoul, for example, in 1987, which changed the whole political structure of the country eventually. The problem is that, you know, Hong Kong is a small enclave against a huge country, China. And the Chinese can put an awful lot of pressure on Hong Kong and on those that, as far as they're concerned, matter in Hong Kong. And students don't matter to the Chinese.
Ivo.
Well, I was just thinking, I fear Jim's pessimistic prognosis is probably correct, but and he mentioned Seoul, but I want to bring it much more up to date. That the student movement in Hong Kong is not dissimilar, is part of the worldwide Occupy movement, that there has been a global insurgency, to use a dramatic word, based a lot on social media. But social media hasn't caused it, and obviously, as we saw in the Arab Spring, social media is not enough. But there is a commonality of both means and ends, stretching from anti-globalisation protesters in Seattle a decade ago through Tahrir Square, and through to Hong Kong. Some of those revolutions have been successful. I don't know, let me rephrase my word. Some of them have had greater impact than others. And of course, what's at the heart of it is political change. Were they symptomatic of political change or were they merely froth? And in those countries where they were symptomatic of political change, they have, things have moved forward. But as Jim was saying, that Hong Kong is not much more than a drop in the ocean when it comes to China, and you probably need political change in China. There has been, I don't need to tell you, there are symptoms, signs of unrest across large different sections of the Chinese population, particularly thinking of the Muslim insurgency. But it hasn't connected, the dot and Tibet. But the dots haven't been connected up, so I suspect that the negative prognosis that Jim's outlined is the correct one.
We're going to have to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, joined by Ivor Gaber and Jim Hoare. When we return, we'll ask whether the world's defence ministries are still fit for purpose. Stay with us.
The Cathay Pacific experience is one of ease and exploration, introducing a contemporary Asian experience to international travel. By placing service at its core, Cathay Pacific evolves with its passengers, creating a home away from home in its lounges and aircraft. Having built its name on service and quality, Cathay Pacific has helped turn its Hong Kong home into a premier transport hub, making the airline one of the world's leading aviation brands. Find out how Cathay Pacific is flying into 2015 and get the view beyond the horizon in The Forecast, the brand new magazine from the editors and bureau of Monocle.
24 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Jim Hoare and Ivor Gaber. On a newsstand near you is the latest publication from Monocle. It's called The Forecast. It's new and it's an annual survey of the year to come. Now, one of the articles, Monocle's Paul Ellis, warns that today's defence ministries are no longer fit for purpose, conceived in the 20th century and in need of being reimagined. Jim, would you agree that those sitting in the likes of Whitehall et al. Really should be taking a long, hard look at what they do?
Well, it's always said that the military always fight the last war, prepare for refighting the last war rather than preparing for new things. And so I think there's an element of truth in what he says about the changes that have taken place in the world and the need for a more overarching approach than sometimes has been the case. It wasn't totally absent in Britain before the recent years. I mean, the Cabinet Office had a certain degree of responsibility for a wider view of things, and there were that brought together the military and the Foreign Office and the Department of Trade and all the rest of it. So I wouldn't dispute the sort of basic idea that things have moved on and you need to take account of it. Whether conventional war, which seems to be another theme floating around in the article, I'm not so sure. In the end, however much cyber warfare goes on, often you still need troops on the ground or ships on the sea or whatever.
You do have this new kind of battle, new kind of front now, which Paul Ellis does mention. He talks about a group of rebellious 17-year-olds, I suspect he's mentioning the likes of Islamic State and those who wage jihad. To what degree, Ivor, do you think that the way that the top-down command-control structure is suited to dealing with that kind of amorphous enemy?
You're absolutely right in the assumption behind your question that it's not suitable, but what is the alternative? The alternative feels to me very Big Brotherish. That is the way that you would best control the recalcitrant 17-year-olds, that we'll have thought control of everybody, the teachers will report upwards. And, you know, we're into 1984. Now, I don't want to over-dramatise it, and I do think there's a very real problem that we've faced in, not just in the West, of the growth of homegrown terrorism, call it what you like. And I do think we need to find new ways of addressing it, but goodness me, we must preserve our civil liberties. And that is the tension at the heart of this issue for me.
I must confess, I tend to agree with you slightly, Jim, in your assessment that we will need wars to be fought on very conventional grounds. I mean, one only need look at what happened in Ukraine for people to suddenly think, well, actually, goodness me, that side of things that hasn't gone away. We actually are needing stronger military defences. And I wonder whether Paul Ellis has missed a trick in a little bit in saying that actually there's an opportunity here for ministries of defence to link together and to strengthen the likes of NATO and the UN.
Ooh, yeah, I'm sure that's right. And I'm sure that's how they would like to see it. I think you're right that there is... there is opportunity for coordination and so on. But I agree with Ivor that the dangers of the way cyber intelligence and so on is being handled are such that it poses a major threat, and that if you let the 17-year-olds and even the 25-year-olds all loose and give them no rules and guidance, which is why you have officers, and however good or bad they are, then you are in a very dangerous situation. And remember, military groups have long had to think beyond the standard troops on the ground thing. Think of Bletchley Park and the Second World War and the decoders. They were the equivalent of your 17-year-olds. They were a bit older, but they were not subject to normal sorts of military discipline or anything like that. They thought outside the rules.
Finally, we must briefly touch on a tantrum. It happened over a bag of macadamia nuts, and it not only forced a Korean Air flight from JFK to turn back to the stand a few days ago, it also caused a rather large PR problem for the airline. The hissy fit was thrown by the daughter of the company's chairman. She also happened to be head of cabin service, well, until she resigned. Jim, when we introduced you, you said that you were ambassador to Seoul.
Really? No, I wasn't ambassador. I was a member of the embassy.
You're a member of the embassy. Don't do yourself dirty. Well, you've built up your part for the last few years here in Monocle 24. Is this symptomatic of the social and economic privileges that is quite common in South Korea, or is this just one very stroppy girl?
Korean family-run companies are like medieval baronies, that the head of the company is treated with great awe and great respect. And for many years, one of the chief newspapers in South Korea had a correspondent based in London. Didn't have really much interest in London, but the reason was that the head of the company, the son of the founder, liked to come to London every year. He'd been at LSE, and he liked to come back for the annual reunion. And the sole purpose of that correspondent was to organise those visits. Korean Air is a family-run empire, and you know, you get delusions.
Just like the North, just like the North Korea, it seems to run in the peninsula.
They are Koreans.
Have you either ever witnessed or seen or been privy to, or actually carried out a very good tantrum? I'm asking you to think on your feet here.
Oh, goodness me. Have I ever? I have on occasion, but if I can very briefly, I was on a South in Johannesburg flying back to London, and a woman in a seat near me had a tantrum. She thought there was a crack in the window. And she was refusing to fly, but she was refusing to move and said she wanted the inspection made. And the pilot said, OK, we'll do that, but we'll have to take all the bags off and we'll be delayed and then the crew will be out of time. So if you're happy, it will delay us 10 hours, but we'll do it. I'll just give you a moment to reflect on it. And the entire cabin stared at this woman. And she changed her mind. So tantrums sometimes don't get you anywhere.
And you landed safely.
The Paddington Bear approach to problems.
Ivor Gaver and Jim Hall, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots more to come in the second half of Midori House. We'll check in with our woman in Vancouver and find out what the world of dance has to offer us. But first, with the time at approaching, 32 minutes past the hour, let's get the latest world headlines now from Paul.
Israel says it's investigating the death of a Palestinian government minister who collapsed soon after a violent confrontation with Israeli troops in the West Bank. Ziad Abuin died in an ambulance on the way to hospital. News footage has shown him scuffling with troops and border police, and at one point a soldier is seen with his hands around the minister's throat. The Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, has called his death a barbaric act. A report in Brazil has highlighted torture, executions and forced disappearances under the country's military rule. Truth Commission says that human rights abuses were official policy under Brazil's military dictatorship from 1964 to 1985. The report was handed to the president, Dilma Rousseff, who was herself arrested and tortured by the military regime. The UN's human rights chief has said that no one involved in the CIA's brutal treatment of terror suspects will be let off the hook. Sidrat al-Hussein says American officials who authorised harsh interrogation could be in breach of the Convention Against Torture. And the head of the Nobel Committee has described the winners of this year's Peace Prize as champions of peace. The Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai shares the award with veteran Indian campaigner for children's rights Kailash Satyarthi. At 17, Malala is the youngest ever recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House Live on Monocle 24. The time is at 21:34 in Moscow, 1834 here in London, 1634 in Rio de Janeiro. Just to let you know, Paul will be back at the top of the hour with a full roundup of today's news. And then after that, Daniel Giacopelli will be here with a brand new episode of Monocle 24's hour designated to the world of business, the entrepreneurs. But in the meantime, now it's time to check in with our correspondent in Vancouver to get the latest from there. We can join Monocle's contributor, Lucy Hislop. A very warm welcome to the programme, Lucy. What's happening where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the key things that is happening is Ottawa working on compensation for thalidomide victims. And, of course, these were people whose mothers during the 60s were given the federally approved drug for morning sickness. And the government at the time didn't withdraw it from the market for about 3 months after they knew that it was tied to severe birth defects. And I think it's just a kind of a reminder. It's 50 years on from that tragedy. And, of course, these people are still, you know, living with their conditions and facing the challenges of aging and may not be able to work and said to be in increasing pain and possible loss, obviously, of their sort of parental support, perhaps. It's just a reminder.
What are they asking for? I mean, obviously, they require justice to be seen to be done and for some remedy to be found. But is the Canadian government giving any indication that any compensation that it might offer will be enough?
Yes, absolutely. They did obviously have a sizable amount of $8.5 million in 1991. Obviously, when they worked out where the troubles were at the beginning and the root of the problem, but there was always a caveat that there may be future needs, and you know, it seems that that time is now. So yes, they are indicating that, I mean, they're driving for a sort of full support of 250,000 Canadian for urgent needs, and then sort of annual payments of between, you know, 75,000 and 150,000. So Federal Health Minister Rona Ambrose is meeting with the victims, and it's said to be working on financial support. So yes, I understand that financial support.
Is there any reason being given as to why Canada has been slower than perhaps other countries may well have been in recognising this and offering money?
I haven't read anything particularly on that. I mean, in many ways, the government at the time was slow to respond to actually, you know, removing the drug in the first place. So I think it's really, you know, I think it's an important story to tell because it is at least happening now. So it's kind of, I'm kind of framing it in that way rather than, you know, why they're slower to do it. It's a good push right now.
Let's have a look at what's happening in Vancouver 24 hours. Charges against pipeline protesters have been dismissed, it says in this article here. And there is someone who looks very much, as you would imagine, a student protester to look like. Camouflage, woolly hat, long hair, slightly rubbish beard, bad placard. But he seems dreadfully happy about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he kind of would definitely want to put you know, pipelines into pipe dreams and leave it there. You know, I always seem to be talking about pipelines when it comes to the West Coast because, of course, Alberta is where the oil sands are. It's landlocked. It needs to get to markets in Asia. Hence, we have a lot of pipelines, and there is now this ongoing debate to try and get the Trans Mountain pipeline expanded for Texas-based Kinder Morgan. They took about 100 people off the mountain and arrested them for civil contempt, and they had everything thrown out. This injunction was thrown out against the protesters because the company apparently supplied incorrect GPS coordinates of where they were doing their sort of fact-finding mission on this Burnaby Mountain. So when you don't get the right GPS coordinates, the legal system throws a book at you and everybody, you know, they had their arrests thrown out. So, yeah, it's an interesting time for the anti-pipeline protesters. It's definitely a very big focal point is Burnaby Mountain.
That was a clearly
you know,
neat little...
Including on the protesters, we had the Union of BC Indian Chiefs who was, you know, arrested whilst he was singing and beating his drum.
That was clearly a neat little legal argument offered, but will it mean that the protesters will be hoiking their way back up to the mountain anytime soon?
Well, yeah, so the Kinder Morton has left the mountain right now because this was just a kind of a recce to see whether it can drill through the mountain. And I think it goes from private land to private land. So, you know, it, as long as they can get through the mountain, then, you know, they say that they can get their new, I think it's, you know, just under 1,000 kilometers of new pipeline that will get the crude out onto the oil tankers. So, yeah, I absolutely believe that there's a groundswell of opposition to the kind of drilling work and to new pipelines. And there is, there are, you know, just ordinary kind of Burnaby residents who, of course, who have witnessed, I think there are more than 200 that were homes that were evacuated in 2007 when they had a rupture of a pipeline. Somebody was, a crew was digging and pierced the pipeline. And so there was, you know, crude spurting over houses and cars.
Lucy,
and
I'm dreadfully sorry. We're going to have to leave it there. That was Lucy Hislop in Vancouver. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we head to the Maldives.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now we venture to the balmy tropics of the Indian Ocean, a place that some have called paradise. The Maldives' exclusive resorts conjure images of holiday bliss. But since 2009, this nation, composed of thousands of islands, has opened up. And the government of the Maldives has made it possible for visitors to venture beyond officially endorsed tourist areas. Well, the experienced travel writer Tom Cheshire has taken full advantage of this and has just written a book about it. It's called Gate Crashing Paradise: Misadventures in the Real Maldives. Well, earlier on Monocle's David Pleasant asked Tom what drew him to cover this part of the world.
Obviously, glossy magazines regularly feature the Maldives on the front cover. It seems like they do every other issue. And I'd learnt of a new way of visiting the country, of going on ferries and cargo ships around the edge of paradise. And this is a new thing that since 2009, it's been possible to go on these ferries and cargo ships. And before then, the government would not allow Westerners, foreigners, to go to the little islands outside the tourist resorts, because the official tourist resorts are kind of just for tourists, not for locals to live in. But the places where the locals live, they were out of bounds for travellers. But a change in government meant a change in rule, and they wanted guest houses to open on the little islands so people could make money directly from tourism and not for the money to go to big Four Seasons hotels and disappear out of the nation. And so it was a democratically elected leader who introduced this policy, Mohamed Nasheed, which came into effect in 2009. This opened up quite quietly, and I talked to kind of different travel journalists about this, including Simon Calder from The Independent, who he, you know, usually knows everything about everything before it's even happened, and he hadn't heard of this. And he was, you know, saying what a great idea to go around. And I decided to buy a ticket, and you can do it quite cheaply. I got a first choice direct ticket on a charter flight without the holiday involved.
That's a good tip. I'm increasingly hearing, in terms of travel on the cheap, just to take the flight element and kiss the hotel goodbye.
Well, I didn't even have to kiss the hotel goodbye because I hadn't bought it, but it was something like £600, which is similar to a fare to Orlando. So I arrived and I got off the plane. Everyone else was led to their luxury tour operators who whisked them off in either high-speed boats or seaplanes to their, you know, $1,000 a night, or possibly not always that much, lovely water villas.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to paint a picture. So the classic resort in the Maldives is these individual huts on stilts where you're very disconnected to, I mean, it's a tropical island, it's sand, it's water, it's this hut. You could really be anywhere. You have no sense of the country whatsoever.
Which goes back to what you were first saying. It could be anywhere, and it strikes most people who've got an adventurous bent that you wouldn't want to go to the Maldives, because what else is there to see except for, you know, an infinity pool and maybe the, you know, a spa massage room. You know, that's about it, apart from the fact is that it is a very, very beautiful place. It's tropical islands with reefs around them and beautiful snorkeling and kaleidoscopes of colourful fish and gorgeous diving, if you're a diver. So there's a lot to recommend it for a tourist, but I wasn't interested in that at all. And so when I got off the plane, I let everyone else go their own way off on their speedboats and their seaplanes. And I went to find out how I got to the capital, which is Malé, which is across the water, about a 20-minute local ferry, which was a small wooden boat, and with about 30 other people before I knew it. And most of the time, you know, the baggage carousel was quite quick. Before I knew it, I was out doing what I wanted to do, which was go on the ferries to see this country and learn about the many issues that affect it, which increasingly unraveled actually during my journey. So before I knew it, I was in Malé. I found a guest house for £35, I think it was. And I was just one street away from the president's palace, the president's office, and in the heart of a bustling, incredibly interesting place with many problems, actually.
Let's maybe describe Malé. It's a fascinating urban scenario, isn't it?
It is one of the most bizarre places on earth, and it took my breath away when I first laid eyes on it. I think I caught a glimpse of it from above on the plane when we were coming in. But when you see it initially from the water, you're talking about a kind of Manhattan-like structure. And many of the buildings are kind of pastel pink, pastel blue. So they're quite colourful or pistachio green. So you've got this kind of multicoloured Manhattan. And in fact, the population of Malé is more densely populated than the real Manhattan, which not many people would expect this. And given that most of you, the Maldives consists of 1,200 islands, a population of 350,000 odd, and 150,000 or so live on Malé in this one small island, which is only 1 mile by 2 miles, is not very big at all. It's a complete shock to the system because there can't be, for many, many hundreds of miles in any direction, all you've got are kind of corals, fish, many deserted islands. And here you've got this incredible concentration of energy, which as a journalist and as a writer, it excited me to kind of think, what's going on here?
Well, that leads me on to my next question. As a travel writer, you know, it's some people might consider the dream profession. It's something that, you know, I'm sure most of us, especially a lot of the people listening or working here at Monocle, right, might one day dream to be. But what's the process? How's your career kind of taken you to this point? How are you in the position now to kind of pick these places? You've written several books, you've gone various exotic places. How's it worked?
Given that I was trained in news, I've always... Travel journalism has slightly changed over the years. It used to be a little bit more newsy, and I was always interested in that side of things, and I would be pushed forward for those stories. But it's changed a bit over the years, and it's now more consumer-led, which is fair enough because people want to spend their money in the correct way and don't want to waste hard-earned cash. But I've always had a newsy side, and that's what took me to the Maldives. And when I was researching this, I discovered a democratically elected leader ousted, rise of extreme fundamentalism, Islamism, smashed Buddhas at the National Museum, human trafficking, so Bangladeshis brought in to construction sites, and then their passports taken, wages not paid, effectively slavery around the corner from where Hilary Swank or the Beckhams were going on holiday and also building many things that they would rely on.
Tom Cheshire there talking to David Pleasant. Tom's book, Gate Crashing Paradise, Misadventures in the Real Maldives, is out now. You with Midori House. Now, many listeners will know that in October, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau moved. It went to the Tomigaya area, a charming little neighbourhood home to a mix of traditional and new businesses. There is, among other things, a tatami mat maker, soba noodle restaurants, a traditional lute artisan, along with bistros, cafes, design-minded select shops. Very nice indeed. Well, this week we take a stroll down the street to meet some of our new neighbours. Well, today we head to Pinyon. It's a small, popular bistro.
My name is Rinpei Yoshikawa. I run French bistro Pinyon in Kamiyamacho. I opened Pinyon in 2010, so we've been here 4 years. This is a French bistro, but I also bring in ideas and inspiration from trips because I like traveling. There's a hint of a North African, a Moroccan influence mixed in.
The restaurant is a narrow space. There are 8 seats at a counter facing the kitchen where Yoshikawa-san and his 3 staffers work. At the front and back of the restaurant are tables that can seat another 20 diners. And during the warm months, Yoshikawa-san opens the terrace so he can accommodate more diners.
We change our menu depending on the season and the ingredients that are available. Of course, some items are on the menu year-round. What's best now is Eizo deer from Hokkaido, and soon we'll serve wild ducks. We recommend game meat here during the winter. We source our own ingredients, fish from Western Japan, for instance. We get seafood directly from Owase Fishing Port in Mie Prefecture. The fish is excellent. We pay attention to quality. It's less important where the ingredients are from. As long as they taste good, that's fine with us. When I started this eatery, there were hardly any businesses around, a few shops. After I opened, others followed, and now it's quite an interesting neighborhood. Although it's not far from the busy fashion district of Shibuya, this is an old shopping street, so there is a great mix of old and new businesses, a butcher, tofu shop, barber, bakery. We are between Shibuya and Yoyogi Hachiman stations. Not many young people come here. It's a bit of a walk from Shibuya. There is a residential area nearby with embassies, and quite a few foreigners live around here too. And we have Yoyogi Park not far away. So it's not crowded, it's a lot more relaxed. There's Shibuya Publishing Booksellers, which is on the intellectual side, some great restaurants, and Monocle too. I think the street is attracting intellectuals, and it's getting more interesting.
And our thanks there to Rinpei Yoshikawa, who's the owner of the French bistro called Pignon, one of the neighbours of Monocle's new Tokyo bureau in the Tomigaya area. You're listening to Midori House. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. Today we talk dance with Louise Levine, journalist and critic with the Financial Times. Welcome to the studio, Louise. You have a sort of a basket of festive treats, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've been having a very busy week, and me and my inner child have been out at the ballet, and more than the ballet, because the most recent opening was at the Royal Opera House, but not ballet at all. It was the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, and it's a hip-hop version by Kate Prince, who brought you Some Like It Hip Hop, which is an update on Some Like It Hot, the movie. Anyway, now she has brought us the Mad Hatter's Tea Party, with the emphasis on the word mad. Alice has a multiple personality disorder.
Right.
You may remember Lewis Carroll has her say, "I knew who I was when I woke up this morning, but I'm not so sure now."
I'm not entirely sure whether this is opening itself up to a children's audience.
Well, I wonder this. But at the same time, you know, OK, the Cheshire Cat is slightly chemically altered, hence the constant smiles. The White Rabbit with his little watch is obsessive compulsive. And a new character is introduced who comes into this day room, essentially, in a mental asylum, and tries to sort them out, but is himself driven mad. So far, so very dark indeed, except that it's hip-hop. So there's so much acrobatic movement involved that the children seem spellbound by that alone. And the design is fabulous. It owes a little bit to the illustrations in the original book by Tenniel. But generally speaking, it's just very lively. Lots and lots of mismatched china and huge teapots and topiary. And what's more, this rather pretty and jolly theme is carried through to the rest of the Limbury Studio Theatre, which is the basement theatre of the Opera House. So it's a lot of fun to be at. And then people start spinning on their heads. So the fact that it is, you know, a kind of psychiatric nightmare is sort of sugared over, shall we say, by the whole, you know.
I'm still struggling to work out who this is aimed at. I'm just looking now. It seems pretty much sold out, apart from one or two performances in the middle of Christmas.
Yeah, well, Lewis Carroll will do that every time. I mean, the Big Alice in Wonderland ballet, which is going on upstairs in the main theatre, is also sold out all the way through to New Year. And people think they're going to like it. They think they know the story. There isn't really a story. It's a series of episodes, and you can take it where you want to take it. And Kate Prince has taken it to a fairly dark place, but in a very jolly, lighthearted way. The music is fab. Lots and lots of soul pastiche. And the Dormouse does a rather beautiful, I want to sleep, He wants to sleep, you know, a sort of soul ballad with a refrain. And the Dormouse is a glove puppet inside the teapot, which I found it hilarious. So that was very jolly.
OK, so if you want an alternative sort of
yes,
Christmas
I wouldn't take the under sevens myself.
OK, fine.
But
if we were just hankering after something a little bit more straight of spine and a bit more traditional, you would suggest that in London, at least, we would head to the Coliseum for the Nutcracker.
I think so. They tend to like it, you know. English National Ballet, who used to be called the London Festival Ballet when they were founded just after the war, began putting on nutcrackers when sugar was still on ration, and they've been doing it absolutely without fail every Christmas ever since. The productions have changed, the spirit is the same. There's something about Nutcracker. There's this Victorian Christmas. It's an 1890 piece, and there is that kind of Victorian Christmas. We're nostalgic for something we don't actually remember. You know, we want skating and snow and urchins, and it's got all of that, and a Christmas tree that grows and grows and grows. So
it ticks every box.
Well, it sort of does. I think I've said this before, but when my children were very small, I used to take them to the first act. Because the first act, you get all the dancing toys, you get the growing Christmas tree, and the rats and mice come out and fight with the toy soldiers, and it's all lovely and action-packed.
And you can be home in time for fish and chips.
And the Nutcracker turns back into a prince, and they go away on a balloon or a goose or whatever the production says, you know. And then the second act is just lots of very, very beautiful dancing, which bores them to sobs. So get the mother-in-law brought in for the second act, and then take the children off to the merry-go-round outside or, you know, shopping or carol singing or something else. It works.
Thank you.
But it is lovely.
This is brilliant, Louise, you're actually giving us children's advice as well.
Well, this is true. I mean, it's true all over the world. I mean, America, there's a Nutcracker in every city and every small town even. And you don't need to sit through the whole thing.
Finally, let's go completely off the wall with the Matthew Bourne production of Edward Scissorhands. Not a traditional piece of art anyway, the original film, but the Tim Burton movie is being what translated onto the stage.
Pretty much. It's a dark and very strange story about a boy who's half finished and given scissors for hands, who at first is an alien in this very, very Doris Day suburban community. And then they realise he can do hair. He can do hair, he can do hedges. And so it's very pretty, but it's rather downbeat. But Matthew Bourne is such a clever choreographer that it ends slightly sadly. And then what happens? It snows in the auditorium. There's a big finish, a sort of choreographed curtain call. And so it's good theatre, and it's good for teens, older children, and
so very briefly,
people with a sweet tooth.
If you had to choose one production, if you were taking a child, and one production, if you weren't, which one would you go for?
Ooh, that's really hard. I think you're always safe with the Nutcracker because everything is there. The music is so great. And
with or without your mother-in-law, of course.
With or without the mother-in-law.
Louise Levine, journalist and critic with the Financial Times. Thank you very much. Well, that's all we have time for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests in the studio today, Jim Hoare and Ivor Gaber. My thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, and our researcher, David Pleasant, Alia Massoud and Claire Lancaster, and our studio manager, Joel Church, too. Next up, after the headlines, is The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. He will be talking about all things matter concerned with the world of business. Then at 2200 hours London time, why not tune into The Monocle Daily? Your host tonight will be Andrew Muller, joined by Ted Kravitz. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, from me, Emma Nelson, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.